Monroe County is Lehigh Valley's neighbor and the center of the Poconos tourist and recreation region, but has successfully moved into not only yellow but the green phase of Pennsylvania's coronavirus reopening process ahead of the Lehigh Valley area. For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting. Lehigh Valley Public Radio is happy to welcome back Maureen Madden, Pennsylvania State Representative of the 115th District, as she updates our listeners on her efforts to help Monroe County residents move beyond this pandemic. Welcome, Maureen.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Monroe County has moved to yellow and now green phase before the Lehigh Valley. What has the local response done to achieve this? How did you guys do it?
Well, we shut down pretty early. When the governor ordered to stay at home, we went to work and contacted the governor's office, and we were able to get him to issue an order to contact, you know, Airbnb and the short-term rentals and let them know that they could not renting short-term right now in the Poconos because we were seeing online advertisements come in quarantine in the corona-free virus Poconos. We worked with March Buses, and they stopped buses from Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, through the Poconos to New York and New Jersey for a month. And then when they opened up again, they had really stringent procedures where they were fumigating the buses. They weren't allowing more than 14 people. We're starting to see people come back into the Poconos now in the yellow phase. And then our hospitals responded so quickly, and East Stroudsburg University responded and made an alternative medical center there in case we should see a spike. So we got it, and our communities, for example, our private communities, the boards, if you have property and you rent short-term, you have to register with many of the private communities so they know who's coming and going. And they issued letters to all of the homeowners that rent short-term and let them know we weren't doing it. So it really was people coming together and working together. And in the yellow phase, I see everybody just an abundance of caution. Everybody's wearing masks. I was in the ice cream store that opened up earlier this week, and they had masks for kids who came in for ice cream, but maybe I saw three kids come in and one young man didn't have a mask, so they had a mask for him. And there's sanitizing stations everywhere. And so I think people were cautious about the yellow phase, and nobody thought, okay, let's go and have a party and all get together. The one exception was, of course, the Black Lives Matter march, in which 2,000 people marched from East Stroudsburg to Stroudsburg, and I was one of them.
You identify as a Democrat. Your party is Democrat. Did the Pennsylvania Democratic Party see success in any anticipated races?
Yes. So there were six counties, I'm sure you know this from Kathy, that I believe got a five-day extension that were hit hard by the pandemic. The governor extended their deadline, I believe, by 5 days to be able to turn in their mail-in votes. So we're going to wait for that. But there are some close races. I know my colleague in Allentown, Pete Schweier, is in a very close race. I know Brian Sims is in a close race. There have been some surprises on our side. We might have lost four members in the primary. We're still waiting for the final results.
Can you describe from your perspective the controversy at the state capitol 2 weeks ago?
Sure. It came to light that one of our colleagues, Representative Andrew Lewis, had come down with coronavirus, and he had been at the Capitol both sessions before. And when he wasn't feeling well, he immediately got tested, and he did everything right. He notified human resources, he notified his leadership, and the leadership, Leader Brian Cutler and Speaker of the House Mike Terzai, deemed it necessary to only tell the Republican members that one of their members had come down with the coronavirus and did not inform the Democratic caucus. We found out in the press. And incredibly irresponsible, because according to the CDC guidelines, when you test positive, you need to let everybody know that you've come in contact with. And so Democrats and Republicans who have been in Harrisburg have been in state government meetings with Representative Lewis, all different meetings. They've been on the floor together. And I'm going to say that my colleagues on the Republican side, by and large, do not wear masks on the floor. I've not been to the floor since March. We went to the floor to pass rules so that we could vote remotely. And because we were a hot spot, especially in East Stroudsburg and Monroe County, our numbers were high early on. I took voting from home and the whole remote session process. But to get back to your point, I joined Brian Sims in calling for Speaker Terzai and Leader Cutler to resign, and I believe they should. because I think it was just dishonest and not fair play not to tell our party that one of their members was infected with the coronavirus.
The risk of exposure to COVID-19 must drive some anxiety for your fellow members. Why do Republican lawmakers in the Pennsylvania Assembly not take this as seriously? Is it a question of not believing the science?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like we've been challenging science the whole time. At a time when science and medicine are the most important thing that are going to get us through this, we're saying, oh, it's just a flu. Let's open up all of our businesses. The governor has been criticized every step of the way by the Republican Party, and yet you look at our numbers. We're reopening in phases. We're doing it in a measured way, and we're not seeing the spike that other states are seeing. Texas, the first week they opened everything pretty broadly, they saw 7,000 people come to the hospital. Georgia, 6,000 people. We are not seeing those numbers. Our hospitals are not reporting large spikes. They feel confident that if there's a second wave, we can handle it. And I think it is the measured way in which the governor and Dr. Levine have handled. Has it been perfect? Absolutely not. Has unemployment been a nightmare? Absolutely. But you can't put that on labor and industry. We've been having those issues since 2011 with unemployment, and this legislature has refused to address this properly. So when you go from 40,000 applications to 1.2 in less than a month, you have to expect an antiquated system to have a trouble handling that. And labor and industry was upgrading the whole infrastructure, and the new system was going to be rolled out in October of this year, and then the pandemic hit, and it kind of slowed that process down and then complicated it by the huge influx of people processing applications. You know, the problem with this is there's a number of us who believe that a pandemic shouldn't destroy our small community. People shouldn't have to choose between their health and opening their business, that we have to make it possible for them to stay on their feet. And I'm going to tell you, I have been at least once a week in our small businesses down in Main Street, up here on the mountain. On election day, I bought wings for poll workers from one of our local businesses that just opened up. I've been in and out of the cafes that are doing curbside. I was in Grandpa Joe's candy store this week buying candy for some students who are having a virtual graduation today. And our business is slow. Absolutely. Are they getting hit? Absolutely. But not too many doors are shuttered. They're still doing curbside. We passed legislation that if you go to a Mexican restaurant and buy some dinner, you can order some margaritas and they'll come sealed and they'll be packed in your car and you can order drinks now, which really helps our businesses who 25% of their sales come from alcohol. I've only been to one big box store, and that's BJ's. Mostly, I have been shopping local. I've been to my local hardware store. So I haven't seen any business monumentally affected by this. Has it been tough? Absolutely. But that's on us. We should have systems in place that protect people, that they don't lose their livelihood because their health could be in jeopardy if they go to work. And all of the people who would come in contact, who would sit in those restaurants and shop in those clothing stores.
What are the reactions of local businesses with the phased reopening plan and all of the restrictions and guidelines that Pennsylvania has laid out for their health and safety?
Overall, I have a district of people who, I'm very fortunate, James, in that I have a district that largely believes in science and medicine. And so they took this serious. And were there a few outliers who were absolutely upset and thought it was tyranny that the governor would issue a stay-at-home order? I'm not going to lie and say everybody thought it was a wonderful idea, but they complied with it nonetheless, and they're reopening cautiously, and I think they're just happy to be in the next phase.
Describe the Pocono Promise and how this initiative came to be.
So the Pocono Mountains Visitors Bureau and United Way have worked so closely with our commissioners, with our local businesses, our resorts, to make sure that we, and they've been our best partners, James, Chris Barrett, the director of the Pocono Mountains Visitors Bureau, and all of the people, Brian Bossett, that work there, reached out to all of the businesses and legislators. And we saw all signed on to the Pocono Promise. We had a virtual signing ceremony. Can't remember the date because days just seem to run into each other. And we signed a promise to commit to adhering to the governor's orders and opening with an abundance of caution, with a phase, I believe, as soon as we turn into the green. Pocono Raceway will be having a race later this month, but there will be no fans. And they work, the governor issued guidelines, and then they issued guidelines for themselves. And I believe their guidelines were even more cautious than the governor's, because everybody wants to do this safely. No one wants to relapse. So that was the commitment, that we adhere to the guidelines, we roll in a phased way, and we do this as safely as possible.
So with the recent primary, how is the turnout at the polls in Monroe County?
The actual physical voting was low voter turnout. However, voting by mail was implemented for the first time in this primary since we passed it last year. And we saw good voter turnout in Monroe County, probably about 15,000 or more voted by mail. And brand new system took a couple of days, but I believe our Monroe County commissioners and all of the county staff did an excellent job of counting all of these votes as quickly as they could, implementing a system that was brand new during a pandemic. I mean, it seemed like everything fell into place and that we had passed this new voting modernization bill and then we got hit with this pandemic. But all in all, I thought it turned out pretty well.
How are your constituents as far as their impressions of the mail-in ballot system and process?
There was a little confusion. A couple thousand people didn't actually turn their ballots in. So I think for the general election, we're really going to have to work around that. The problem with this new voting modernization bill, James, is that there was no fiscal note attached to it. There was no money appropriated to this bill to properly be able to inform our constituents of the new procedures. And that was a big part of the bill for me as to why I didn't vote. I didn't actually vote for this bill because I thought not attaching a fiscal note. And we also did, I mean, it turned out to be great in the end that we didn't put it off because we and our party were looking to put it off to the next election because we thought it would be too new for such a big election. And I guess November will tell. And then the other reason I didn't care for this bill is I didn't think it went far enough in voting modernization. You know, I mean, people could vote 50 days ahead. But if you want to show up, I do believe you should be allowed time off to go vote. I believe there should be another day to vote. Maybe give people a holiday. And then the last thing was that they got rid of straight ticket voting. And there are so many people who have for decades and decades and decades just, they know who they're voting for. They press the lever for straight ticket. So all of it was kind of confusing to some voters. But all in all, I would say the feedback that I got was very good. They were happy to have it. They were happy they didn't have to leave their homes. And the poll workers were happy as well because, you know, not everybody wants to wear a mask. So they were a little concerned with their public safety. But everyone was cleaning. I went to all of my polls and all of our judges of elections were cleaning all the machines after each person voted and the sanitary procedures were excellent. So all in all, I would have to say it was more positive than negative.
Did any of your district's polling places have new voting machines?
All of them did. We went from the curtain and the lever to sitting at a table with the big voting privacy screen and a paper ballot in which you color in the circles like we used to do for standardized testing in school.
Just like those Scantron tests from high school?
Yes, Scantron. And then you put your ballot in a folder and you handed it to the poll worker and you watched your vote get tabulated and then you got your voting sticker and your vote was counted. And while this might be new to folks, well, we did use these same machines in the local elections last year, so they are familiar with them, but it's not that big a change. It takes a couple of minutes. If you're, you know, elderly, you get to sit and look at it and read it. So I personally like the idea that there is such a strong paper trail, for especially when we're implementing a new voting system. One of the things that was tied to the reimbursement money that the counties got for the new machines was the ability for counties to purge their voter rolls. And there wasn't a uniform, like every 3 years or 5 years, and I don't personally care how many years. I don't think we have a right to be purging voter rolls. If people show up to vote, they show up to vote. If they don't, they don't. It's your one man, one vote constitutional right. I don't think counties should be enticed to purge voter rolls by reimbursement for voting machines. Something fundamentally wrong with that. I know when my son Alex moved from Pennsylvania to New York to become a police officer, I received a letter maybe 2 years after he left because he forgot to write a letter and ask them to take his name off the rolls. And I forwarded to him and he responded. So I really liked that idea. They look at the rolls and they see how long it's been. 2 years seems like a pretty good time for me to contact voters and let them know, hey, you haven't voted in 2 years. Are you still here? That kind of thing. Because there was a woman when I was at one of the polls who was inactive and they made her fill out a ballot, an attestation form that this was her and she was still registered and she wanted to vote. She was still able to vote, but she had to sign this attestation form. And I don't think it's fair.
Well, who sets the criteria and then who enforces the criteria? Why do it?
Counties. County commissioners are the judges of elections, and the ability to purge rolls was written in this legislation. And I don't believe, I'm not positive, I wouldn't say 100%, but I remember not being happy that there was no time frame or that there was even it written into the bill that counties could or were required to purge rolls.
It seems as if there is a logical argument for people who have passed away, but again, there could be verification practices that could easily do that. So other than that, what's the reason to purge?
None whatsoever. None. My goodness, look at Stacey Abrams. 30,000 people were purged off the rolls. It's voter suppression. I believe it's voter suppression in its most baseless form. Don't go vote by mail. It's not safe. I mean, I had a woman reach out to me and say, Steve, I could have voted 6 times. I received 6 ballots in the mail. Maybe there were people who had lived there before because she was a renter, or maybe she had relatives that weren't voting anymore and she got their voter forms. But when they scan it, the Scantron knows your name. If they tried to slip another ballot in there with the same name, the machine would know. It will only count a name once. So just there's so much misinformation and misnomers out there. And it's because one party will benefit from voting by mail over another party because the other party doesn't believe in it and doesn't encourage it. Yet the military's been doing it for years. There's been a conservative Republican group that's been running commercials, and I don't know if you have seen them, but it's a gentleman who has been a career military man who talks about, the first time I ever voted was for Richard Nixon, and then I voted for Ronald Reagan twice in every other presidential election since then by mail because I've been a career military man and have been overseas, and there's been no problem. So I believe the Republican Party has been pushing back a little on the president and the notion that no one should vote by mail because it's not safe and it just opens up to all kinds of voter fraud. When that's coming from the top, there are diehard followers who are going to, hey, the president said don't vote by mail. The logic escapes me.
Based on the extensive conversation we had with Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar, the possibility of foreign interference or voter suppression or voter fraud was nearly impossible.
And Kathy Buchvar has been excellent at her job. I've known her for a long time, even since she ran for judge probably 8 years ago. And she's done a very good job overseeing this new legislation.
Your fellow representative, Brian Sims of the Philadelphia area, had a Facebook Live video that went viral in regards to the controversy with the Republicans in the state assembly. Do you feel that will help or hurt his reelection chances in the primary?
I don't think it hurts him. Brian Sims is controversial for a number of reasons, and any one of those. He received some negative press a few months back, for which he apologized on the floor for overreacting. Brian lives next door across the street from a Planned Parenthood, and when there are protesters there, Brian feels inclined to go there and escort women into the clinic for whatever reason they're there. And he got into an altercation with some pro-life protesters because they're always out there, and he said some things he regretted and apologized. But he's always controversial. He's an openly gay legislator fighting for equality. We are one of the only states that despite the fact that 70% of Pennsylvanians believe you should not be discriminated against because of who you love in your job or in housing, we refuse to introduce that legislation and pass it. And for an openly gay legislator or my brother who is openly gay or any LGBTQ member of our community in the Commonwealth, you have a right to equality. And the LGBTQ community is the only unprotected class in our Pennsylvania human rights legislation, the only class of people who don't enjoy the same equality as the rest of us. So maybe he, out of frustration, he doesn't always handle every situation well, but his passion is real and his heart is in the right place. And I stand by my colleague. He's a friend of mine, and I sincerely hope he ekes this out.
I'm always impressed with your constituent and community involvement. Can you describe a typical day in the life of Maureen Madden with your outreach programs and initiatives?
Sure. So we talk about our small businesses. I'll just give you a brief synopsis of the kinds of things that I've been doing. I'm not sure that you know, but 3 weeks ago, we got a shout out on Facebook that a farmer in Salisbury, Mr. Zimmerman, for some reason had an abundance of eggs. And when I say an abundance of eggs, I believe it was 20,000 dozen eggs that he was unable to distribute. And so they put a call out, and a tree farmer, Neola Tree Farm, said, come use my property. We'll set up a structure to protect the eggs, and we can commandeer this traffic-wise, and we'll put a call out there, and people will come, and they'll pick up the eggs, we'll put them in the car, they'll pay ahead of time or with a credit card. And so I went and I bought 300 dozen eggs and I loaded them up into my vehicle. And I went to my little mom and pop cafes that I frequent when I can sit there and eat. And I said, do you need some eggs? And I went to Kitchen Chemistry, my local bakery. And I said, I know it's been tough for you. And here, I have 45 dozen eggs. Do you need them? And so I did that. I went and visited my small businesses and asked them what they needed, gave them some eggs. I went to the Wesleyan Church, gave them eggs because they've been feeding people. People have been driving through, and they're feeding about 200 families a week, providing groceries for them. And as well, the East Stroudsburg United Methodist Church has been cooking for people and serving full meals with condiments, and they're warm, and they have utensils. So if you're homeless or you're struggling, you can go to the United Methodist Church in East Stroudsburg, and Anna Price and her small team of volunteers are literally there 12 to 14 hours a day making meals for people. So anything that I could do to support them, and we were able to get them some grant money, $88,000 to the Wesleyan Church, and I believe it was $37,000 to the East Stroudsburg United Methodist Church to continue the work that they're doing. So that was one area in which I helped. And today we're having a virtual graduation for an empowerment program where students are identified as having great potential and maybe they're struggling in other areas. So they work through this program and they graduate. And normally there's a luncheon in which we, all the legislators, honor them. But because of the pandemic, we can't sit down and eat in a restaurant. We're having a virtual ceremony. So Senator Scavello and I teamed up and we created these gift bags for the students, and from Bushkill to Kunkeltown to East Stroudsburg, and I dropped off these bags with certificates and little gifts for them and took pictures with the students and chatted with their families and just congratulated them on their achievements. So when we have this virtual ceremony, I've spoken with these students. And the other part of it was there was this young man who I spoke with, and he couldn't meet me because he was at work. He is a welder. He graduated from MCTI and immediately went to work welding. And I was able to get $500,000 for the MCTI welding program my first term because their welding equipment was in excess of 40 years old. And those students had to go somewhere else to get certified because their equipment didn't even meet the standards. So I spoke with Governor Wolf and the Department of Labor, and we were able to provide $500,000 to upgrade not only what they needed, but beyond their expectations. And then they were able to give out $18, $2,500 scholarships for adult students who wanted to come back. And one older woman in my district, I met her in the supermarket a couple of months ago, and she said, I'm learning culinary skills, and I got a scholarship from this program. So when you're in your community and you see what a difference it's making, it's so heartwarming for me to see the work that I'm doing play out in my constituents' everyday lives. So that's the importance of going into the community, is letting people know that we understand everything is virtual and everything is a Zoom meeting and you're all at home and we're wearing masks when we leave our house, but we haven't forgotten about you and we appreciate that what you're doing to make sure that we all stay safe. So, that's kind of my responsibility to my community and my constituents. And we didn't touch upon it, James, but I don't know if you know about the Wesleyan Church drive-in service that happened on Thursday. The Wesleyan Church has a big parking lot, and the cars came in, and they tuned into 91.9, and there was music, and legislators spoke, and pastors spoke. Rabbi Melman and a pastor from the Mission Church, which is a Latin church, spoke. It was the most beautiful scene, and it's on Facebook. If you go to the Wesleyan Church, you can watch the footage, because it was a Facebook Live, and then they shared it and saved it. And there were people who had sunroofs who were standing up outside their sunroof. And it was just a beautiful coming together. And I have to tell you, that service, and Pastor Linda prayed over my children, that did more to calm my nerves and lift my spirit than anything. The peaceful protest, the acknowledgement of this, is the most healing thing we can do. And if you haven't watched that, you should, and if you can, touch upon it, because it was a beautiful ceremony.
You mentioned Pennsylvania Senator Marius Covello, a Republican. How mm-hmm. often are you working in bipartisan ways? There's a bitter political climate of partisanship. How often are you working across the aisle, and is it as bitter as the media portrays?
So we compartmentalize our duties as legislators. There are things that I know that Senator Scavello and my other Republican colleagues and I are never, ever going to agree on, like a living wage or universal health care or equitable school funding or a rational and workable property tax solution. Those are things that we are going to, I personally believe, and I'm being partisan right now, that Democrats have to have a majority to be able to implement sensible legislation that works for everyone, because our legislation is very upside down right now. We're not interested in doing the hard job of making sure that our school funding is equitable. We'd have to, or making sure that our charter schools are not getting tens of thousands of dollars more per student as our traditional brick and mortar schools are, which they are right now, because the lobbyists work so hard and they give so much PAC money. So in those ways, we do not work together, and there is a bitter divide because our voices are not being heard in the Democratic Party. But here at home, Senator Scavello and I care about our constituents' daily lives. For example, what I did yesterday in delivering the gifts and the certificates, it makes a meaningful difference in someone's life on a local level. And those are the things we're able to agree on. And those are the areas in which we can work. And so in any way that we work together to achieve bipartisanship for the good of our constituents, the ones that we share, that we have in common, is productive for them. They like to see that we're working together, and it makes our lives more manageable. And I'm open to working with anyone I can.
The tragic death of George Floyd, along with police brutality and systemic racism, are current topics. How are you involved on a local level with Black Lives Matter and George Floyd protests?
Sure. So I'm a member of the NAACP, and I work very closely with the NAACP and its president, Krista Caceres, for equality here in Monroe County and to have our voices heard and to implement legislation. Apparently, you have to legislate humanity, and police officers, not all, but a small number of them, have to be told that, you know, it's just not a good idea to put your knee on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 45 seconds, or to put someone in a chokehold. And now we're finding out that there are states like Washington that have neckties, that they put ties around people's necks. Come on, James, that's how we brought slaves here. I mean, this is the 21st century. What was the 60s all about? We are reliving. I feel right now we're reliving 1968, that the unrest is so volatile right now. And quite frankly, without the outside groups that are largely looting and causing all of this discontent, because whether they be racist groups, KKK, white supremacists, different groups that don't want equality, but they're disruptors. They're disruptors. We haven't seen that here. We largely have had peaceful protests. We had the NAACP. There may be 100 people, 200 people came, and it was members of the NAACP, Delta Sigma Theta, which is a women's sorority, National Council of Negro Women, Kaya, Jack and Jill of the U.S., which is a group for young Black men and women students, empowering them, teaching them that they have a right to equality and to do it in a thoughtful and intelligent way. And they all spoke from their heart. And we honored George Floyd and the other Black men and women who have lost their lives in recent months. And it was a beautiful prayer vigil. And my husband, who is a local musician, sang, and we prayed with local religious leaders, and it was a beautiful, comforting ceremony. We are going to honor the lives of those lost, but we are putting people on notice that we need legislative action. And I know that Governor Wolf unveiled a new platform for achieving equality, investigating crime, investigating how the police interact, making sure we have uniform practices across the Commonwealth. I'm very interested in pursuing body camera legislation. And from my initial talks, I understand there are police departments that feel that it's safe for the people, the public, and the police officers. You know that I have two children who are NYPD, and they're on board with body cameras. They wear them, and it protects everybody. No one can say this happened if there's a body camera that's showing the footage. So it was a memorial service and a call to action. And then there was a march started by this young man in East Stroudsburg by the name of Kasim Johnson, 25-year-old young man who just decided that he had had enough and it wasn't enough to be outraged with his friends and family, that he wanted to do something that was real, that something called light to the injustices happening all over this country. And so he put out a flyer, and it caught our attention. And he didn't put his name on it, and there was no organization. So a number of us in the community reached out and said, you know, whose flyer is this? Who's sponsoring this? And he called me back. I put my name out there and my phone number out there. And he called me back and spoke to some of us older hippie protesters. And we gave him advice as to what to do and stay on the sidewalk and, you know, have bullhorns and have marshals. Talk with the local police, the local sheriff, and I couldn't be any prouder of our local police department, Chief Jen Lyons from Stroud Regional, and Sheriff Ken Morris, and all the deputies who all came out and marched alongside of us and stood with us at Courthouse Square. 2,000 people converged on Courthouse Square, James, and it was nothing but love and action and sharing stories. When we all broke up in a peaceful manner. There was not one incident. Monroe County showed the country how you protest and how you call for action and how you do it in a way that respects each other's humanity, yet identifies and acknowledges that we are not all equal, and that's what we're working towards. And I was so proud to speak at that event. Congressman Cartwright came, and it was just a moving, beautiful event, and all credit to Kasim Johnson and his friends who pulled off this event that normally would take dozens and dozens of people, and he did it in a relatively short time in a really effective way.
I understand Monroe County Sheriff Ken Morris was there and marched with them.
Yes, he was. He marched with them, and he spoke about that his sheriffs are instructed that everybody should be treated equal and everybody's treated with respect. And the other thing about this is we all want to believe that all of our law enforcement are in lockstep with us and how we treat people, no matter, because when you arrest someone, they are still innocent till proven guilty. I like that these law enforcement leaders went on record and said, this is what we stand for, because they have, in fact, held themselves accountable by going on record and saying, yes, we believe that everyone is entitled to be treated with dignity. And so I liked the idea that they came out and supported us and went on record by saying, absolutely, we believe in equality. We believe that injustices need to be addressed.
You've mentioned previously that your two sons are NYPD police officers and work in law enforcement. How much more challenging has it been with the social unrest, the calls against police brutality, and dealing with COVID-19 all at the same time in the New York metropolitan area?
Well, it's been brutal. As the mom of two New York City police officers, I can tell you I probably have slept maybe 10 hours this entire week, because one of my children works from 11 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock in the morning, and they can be deployed wherever is the hot spot. And it seemed like the whole city was a hot spot. My son said Chelsea at one point looked like it had been hit by a drone strike. The looting, the devastation, stores that had boarded up their windows, the wood was pulled down, and the stores were looted, and the destruction and the fighting, and it was just a really volatile situation. And I'm going to tell you that New York City police officers, while there are definitely instances, my youngest son worked for many, many years, not only as an elected PBA delegate, so worked between administration and law enforcement, but he was also for 9 years an administrator to the training sergeant. So I can tell you that NYPD, once they graduate from the academy, the continued sensitivity training, whatever new policies they're implementing, they are constantly being retrained and updated with new policies and being exposed to sensitivity training. You know, there's a misnomer that, you know, every police officer has a stun gun or every police officer reacts in a physical way. It's just not true. I mean, if you are a New York City police officer and you have a stun gun, you've gone through extensive training to understand how powerful that stun gun is. And the idea that diffusing a situation with a stun gun is saying, I have this stun gun and I really don't want to use it, but you're going to have to calm down, right? And when a police officer is in the academy, they all get mates, so they know what that feels like. So there is sensitivity training going. And what I've heard from my children who are out there every day in the thick of it is they wished the governor and the mayor would work closer together and not pit each other against one another, because it made the very early part of the week, when it was most intense, difficult. And then as they finally got it and they worked around things that didn't work, like an 11 o'clock curfew in New York City, you might as well say, just stay up for the rest of the night. Or there's 36,000 officers, James, and the first night of the protest, they only deployed 4,000. In a city of nearly 9 million people, how does that make any sense? Or the mayor of New York City said, no, I don't need the National Guard. They don't understand our urban environment. Well, you know what? If you had deployed the National Guard to protect property, the New York City Police Department could have spoken to protesters as they were doing later in the week, taken a knee, hugged them, listened to them. I watched the captain last night on CNN in real time diffuse the situation after the curfew and said, listen, guys, it's late. Go home. We're going to be here tomorrow. You can come back. And he put his hand out and he shook the protesters' hand. They hugged and they moved along. And had the police been given the tools that they needed to do that from the beginning, I think a lot of this violence and a lot of this looting wouldn't have happened. But we had these two people at the top, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, just arguing amongst themselves, and the police officers and the protesters, and as I've been calling them all week, the peaceful protesters and the peacekeepers, were at odds with each other. And it was a shame that it took, I'm going to say, till Thursday for it to diffuse. But I'll tell you what really went a long way was when Attorney General Keith Ellison handed down the indictment for all of the officers, not just the officer who put his knee on George Floyd's neck, but those who were complicit by standing around and watching. And when the one officer said he cannot breathe, should we turn him over? And for the officer who was responsible for George Floyd's death, said, no, we're just going to stay here for a while. They're all complicit. And I applaud Attorney General Ellison for investigating and waiting and not rushing to judgment and handing down the indictments he did. And I agree with him 100% when he said, we have to work for a time when police officers aren't undercharged for their crimes and black people aren't overcharged for their crimes. And I think the indictment of second degree murder, I believe it was a fair step in achieving this goal that everybody get equality, no matter whether you wear a badge or you're a citizen walking the street.
It's refreshing to hear your sons feel that way, although there are reports that there are much more aggressive training techniques and instructors who frame training as a war on crime. Are your two sons witness to that?
No, because my children don't have that attitude when they go out on the street. You know, that's been my fear when police are having bricks hurled at their head and bottles of urine or bottles of water. And my son tells me, like, just the most horrible things. And they're still taught not to react violently to try to defuse the situation in the most peaceful manner. And so the war on crime is the 21st century of three strikes, you're out. Those severe laws where for the smallest infraction, these are the laws that we have to systematically legislate out of law. We have to start working towards more equitable criminal justice. And shame on the governors, I think, who haven't had a handle on their departments and there haven't been uniform policy, but good on the protesters who have brought that to light. And I commend the governors who now acknowledge it as the problem and are going to work on it. And as legislators and activists, we are going to hold them accountable. If they think we're going to stop after George Floyd's funeral ends, they are sadly mistaken. We are now in a place where we're going to hold people accountable because across this country and the globe, people in Germany and England had protests for George Floyd. There is a call to action across the globe that this injustice is not going to stand, and we are going to do it on the state level because there's been a real lack of leadership from Washington. The war on crime, this is not leadership, and it's making it harder to pick up where our president and our national leaders, our federal legislators, some of them, not all of them, some of them do not want to take up the cause.
Please share with our listeners your thoughts on the protests in Washington where unmarked and unidentified law enforcement may have infringed on citizens' constitutional rights. Does that concern you?
Absolutely. You know, anything that's not the National Guard or actual police departments concerns me. And that was another reason why we should have had the National Guard. There could have been double, triple the police officers deployed so they could have been in the crowd. There could have been a contingent of officers who were keeping the peace, arresting the agitators, and then there could have been those who were marching and following and protecting the peaceful protesters. And now it shows how inadequately we are prepared in this country for a pandemic or a protest or any large event. We have to have those contingencies in place. Why did we ignore them? To our peril, to the death of over 100,000 people. We got to get smarter in this country.
Let's talk about county commissioners and First Amendment rights. We have a South Whitehall Township Commissioner, Matthew Mobilio, has calls for his resignation because he had a social media post that said, if you support Donald Trump, you are also a disgrace and should be hung for treason. But also Montgomery County Commissioner Joel Gale has called Black Lives Matter a, quote, a radical left-wing hate group and, quote, perpetrators of this urban domestic terror. What is your reaction to both of those examples, and should either of them resign?
Yes, absolutely. They went too far. That's hateful rhetoric that doesn't do any good. If you want to denounce the president, I'm fine with that. I denounce the president pretty much every single day. I think he is not a leader. And I think he has divided this country. And quite frankly, when Donald Trump says, you know, I'm the supreme leader, I can do this, I can do that, he's taking away our democracy. We will be in peril. And I say that pretty vocally all the time. And my answer to that is get out and vote. And this election showed in Monroe County, Democrats came out in large numbers. So that call to action has to be positive. You have to motivate people to care about their government and what's important to them and get them to act on that way. So to be too radical on the left or too radical on the right and to suggest that people be hung or to use racist terms, it's just unacceptable. And those people all, we have a responsibility as legislators to communicate action and our thoughts in a responsible way. And to suggest that anybody should be hung, that's exactly what we're fighting for in Black Lives Matter. And it's not a left-wing radical. It wasn't when Dr. King marched, and it wasn't when Congressman Cartwright marched with Representative Lewis a couple of years ago. It's still the same struggle, and we keep fighting until we get the equality that we need. And if you're not a legislator or an elected official helping the situation, you're hurting the situation, and you might as well step aside.
What would you like to share with our listeners about Monroe County moving past the pandemic?
Monroe County is thriving. We've hit some rough spots with this pandemic. We're coming out of it. We're, you know, I'm downtown, and there are people down there going in our shops, wearing masks, acting responsibly. Shopkeepers are happy to see people. We're moving forward. Our commissioners, our resort owners, our tourism board, our United Way continue to work together to make sure that we do this in a measured way. I think probably my only disappointment was District Attorney Christine, who said he wouldn't hand out any citations or any warnings or implement the governor's stay-at-home order in any way. I felt that that was irresponsible, and I think it hurt the situation. But by and large, the people of Monroe County acted responsibly, and in the long run, his lack thereof, oversight wasn't necessary, because we acted responsibly as citizens.
Thank you, State Representative Maureen Madden. Our neighbors in the Poconos and Monroe County recognize all that you do. WDIY appreciates your update during this trying time.
Thank you, James. My pleasure.
For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.